just talk a little bit to make sure.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Absolutely perfect.
Tell me when to start, Ben.
Yeah, whenever you are comfortable, Grandma. Go for it.
My name is Debs Lowenson, and I am Ben Van Hook's grandmother. For hobby, I write short stories, which by professional literary standards are ordinary. But my friends seem to enjoy listening to them, and Ben has suggested I record some of them so that when I eventually go into Never Never Land, my family can hear my voice and laugh at some of my efforts. I have many quirks. I believe in angels, and one of my stories, not necessarily the first one, is about an angel who is on probation, but I'll explain as I go along. The first story I'm about to read is a simple love story, which I hope you will enjoy. It's called The Last Love. He watched her through the tangled undergrowth that had grown up around the old neglected tombstones. He was not sure whether he would find her there, but he knew that this was a favourite part of the old cemetery, which he often frequented, and he so much wanted to see her. His love for her was overwhelming, and as the autumn light struggled to get through, her auburn hair glowed and her long slender fingers gently plucking the half-dead pink roses filled him with awe. He so much wanted to be with her, to hold her, to wake up with her lovely face beside him every morning, to look after her and to tell her how much he meant to him and how much he loved her. But it wasn't as if he hadn't known her for a long time. They had both lived in the small village in the Cotswolds all their lives. They had attended the local village school. He had been two classes above her. She'd been a thin, gawky little girl, her bushy hair tied up in two plaits, her socks always falling down her skinny legs. Really not much to look at when they were all running around in the small playground. But as time passed, both of them had grown up. She had lost her gawkiness. The plaits disappeared, and she developed into a beautiful young woman. He had grown strong and tall, and his army uniform suited him. Their mothers had become friendly, and his mother had asked her mother whether she would consider him as a pen pal whilst he was away. She had not been keen on the idea, as she hardly knew him, but she had reluctantly agreed. Dear John, you will probably be surprised to receive this letter, and I really don't know how to start. Maybe you remember me from school, the skinny little girl whose pigtails you always pulled, remember? Well, it looks as if our mums have got together and asked if I would write to you whilst you are away, so here goes. To be perfectly honest with you, there's not much news at the moment. The village is much as it was when you went away, except that now we have evacuees from London in most houses. They really are a strange group of kids. One can hardly understand them with their Cockney accents. Most of them have never been out of London before. They're scared of everything. The grass, the cows. All they really want to do is to go back home. But with London being bombed night after night, they are safer staying with us. Rationing is difficult. You remember Mr. Johnson, the butcher? Well, poor man, his shop is virtually empty, and everybody argues with him about the small amount of meat and sausages they are allowed. But it's not his fault, and we just have to manage as best we can. I'm working in the office at the clothing factory. Now, all we do is make uniforms, which is a bit boring, but with the war on, we have no option. But that's enough of my news, John. How are things with you? Please write soon. It will be nice to hear from you. Love, Rosemary. Dear Rosemary, thank you for writing. Of course I remember you, the skinny little girl with the pigtails. Did pulling them hurt? If so, I apologise, and I promise I won't pull them again. There's not very much to tell you about life in the army. At the moment, it's very much routine. Cleaning our boots, marching up and down the barracks, having a little time off to go to the local pub with my friends. But rumour has it we will be off somewhere shortly, and if so, it may be difficult to write. So don't worry if you don't hear from me, but please, please write. You have no idea how much I appreciate hearing from you. It does, to a certain extent, keep me sane. Love, John. Dear John, can't write much now. I've volunteered for the Army Land Corps and I'm off to the country to grow potatoes and vegetables. We'll write soon. Love, Rosemary. Dear Rosemary, glad to hear you are doing your bit to help the war effort. Make sure you don't kill any of the plants, but things are hotting up and I may not be able to write regularly. Take care of yourself and I'll write as soon as possible. Love, John. John knew that it would not be too long before polishing his army boots and having a drink in the local pub with his friends would eventually lead to being a soldier in every sense of the word. And shortly after his last letter to Rosemary, he found himself on an army ship sailing to North Africa under the leadership of General Montgomery. There would be no more letters for a long time. The desert came as a shock to John, having hardly almost never been out of his Cotswold village. Miles and miles of yellow sand with no trees, no houses, nothing to break up the monotony of the yellowness, was almost as depressing as the perpetual noise of the enemy's guns. He was a good and obedient soldier and was soon given his corporal stripes. And although he was pleased to receive the recognition, he knew that this gave him more responsibility towards his comrades. Many around him were killed, others seriously injured. And although the medical officers did their best to save as many lives as they could, the number of casualties rose every day. Morale was low until the Battle of El Alamein, which became a turning point in the Western Desert Campaign. Slowly the war changed its course, and towards the end of 1944-45, it was obvious that the Allies had pulled through and Germany was at last defeated. And so John was once again able to resume his letters to Rosemary. But the John who wrote the initial letters to her was not the same John. This John had seen his comrades killed. He had seen young German soldiers, hardly out of their teens, killed and taken prisoners, with all their confidence knocked out of them. They were all so young, so naive. What did any of them know about wars and killing? What difference did it make where you were born or what side you were fighting on? They were all human beings. What had the war achieved? John was eventually demobilised. His return to the village was celebrated with a party in the village hall, where banners welcoming him home were displayed and everybody was invited. Rosemary was looking forward to seeing him again, but their reunion was awkward and uncomfortable. To write letters was, to a certain extent, impersonal in a way, but being face to face with each other was different. They had both changed. The war years had affected them in different ways, and they were no longer the boy and girl who knew each other from way back when. They liked each other, they were attracted to each other, but something intangible separated them, and neither quite knew how to handle it. He walked her home after the village party, but their conversation was stilted, and the slight peck on the cheek when they said goodnight did not really mean anything to either of them. Their post-war life resumed, and from time to time they met up for a meal or to go to the pictures. And although she always seemed pleased to see him and spend time with him, there seemed to be a barrier between them. She loved being in the country and took long walks by herself. Often she would find herself in the old cemetery at the edge of the village. The gravestones dated back hundreds of years and the shrubbery was overgrown, but she felt at peace there and she enjoyed the tranquility which the old cemetery offered her. She would pick the wild roses which grew around an old grave and would sit smelling their faded fragrance whilst dreaming, possibly of John, and wondering whether there was going to be any future for them. She was totally unaware that on that particular afternoon, whilst the tired autumn sun was dappling through the trees, that he was watching her. She knew that she was falling in love with him, but she was not sure how he felt about her. The times they spent together were good, and they were slowly learning how to relax in each other's company. But he had not put into words how he felt, and she just was not sure. He watched her sitting on the old gravestone smelling the roses. She was so beautiful. She was everything he wanted in his life. Now was the time to tell her. As I mentioned earlier, I do believe in angels, and the next story I'm going to read to you is about a probation angel. Now, probation angels take about 80 to 100 years, but there was a shortage of angels in this particular story, and I will read you the story and you will understand why. It's called David's Story. Having passed a few elementary tasks and enjoying my probationary period, I was suddenly called upon to undertake something serious. There had been a tremendous call on angels, and the shortage led my supervisor to temporarily upgrade me to the post of a guardian angel. Although in one way I was flattered by the confidence shown towards me, I was quite apprehensive about the task. I was asked to look after a little Jewish boy called David, who lived in Vienna, Austria. The Nazis were making life intolerable for the Jewish population, and David's parents were trying to save their children from the horror of being sent to a concentration camp. His sister, who was 4 years older than him, had already disappeared from the family. He knew not where she had gone, and now it was his turn to be sent away. As a boy of 6 years old, he had little understanding of what was going on. And when his parents told him he was going on a big train with lots of other children, and maybe after that on a big boat, he thought the whole experience great fun. His parents had packed him a small suitcase with a picture of the family in it and gave him a big kiss and told him they would all be together again very shortly. He found the journey exciting and played games with the children, all of whom had a similar small case and a label around their necks with a number on it. On arriving, he was surprised when kind people met him, but he could not understand what they were saying as he only spoke German, and these people did not speak a language he understood. But they smiled and were kind and took him home. I, of course, as his guardian angel, was always by his side. David was taken to the home of a kind Christian family who welcomed him with both arms. They had two little boys of their own, and in no time he settled down to a comfortable life with Mr. and Mrs. Lambert and their two sons, Gary and Edward. As time passed, he did not entirely forget his former life, but the memories became hazy, and to all intents and purposes, he became a little English boy. To give Mr. and Mrs. Lambert credit, they did try to keep in touch with David's parents, and during 1939 and 1940, letters passed between them. They had a dilemma as to how much to tell David, and tried hard to protect him from the bad news that was coming through about the plight of the Jewish people in Europe as the Nazis advanced. Suddenly the letters stopped altogether. As the years passed, David grew into a clever young man and did well at school. At university, he studied politics and economics, and his foster parents were proud of him. They loved him and he loved them, and he was happy and well adjusted. Although theoretically they were Christians, religion did not play a big part in their lives. They went to church for weddings and funerals, and David went with them. But at no time did they consider it necessary to discuss his childhood life with them. He was now part of their family, and they saw no reason to change things. One day Mr. Lambert came home with some good news. He had been offered promotion in his firm and was going to be the senior officer in a branch not too far away, and a four-bedroomed house came with the job. By that time, the children were older, and moving seemed to be quite a good idea. So off they went to a lovely little village a few miles away. At university, David's best friend was Leo, who was Jewish, but there were many Jewish students, and it just so happened that David and Leo had a lot in common and enjoyed each other's company. One Friday evening, Leo invited David to have dinner with him at Hillel House, which was a meeting place for the Jewish students, and David happily agreed at the thought of a free meal. About 40 students were present, and when the chairman asked one of the girls to light the candles and welcome in the Sabbath, David found himself strangely moved, and a faint memory stirred within him, but he could not exactly explain it. He enjoyed the evening, he enjoyed the food and the banter, and started to accompany Leo on a regular basis. When he went home for half term, he told his foster parents about going to Hillel House, and it was then that they felt it was time to tell him how he had come to them and why. Mrs. Lambert took him up to the loft and showed him the little suitcase he had brought with him, the label he had had around his neck with the number 233 on it, the photograph of his family, and the letters that had passed between them and his family in 1938. David's emotions were very mixed. He loved his foster parents and his foster brothers. He felt very comfortable with them, and now he was all mixed up. It took him a long time to come to terms with the news that he was Jewish and that he had had a family in Austria. A part of him felt that it was necessary to find out more, and he had long chats with Leo about what he should do. One thing Leo suggested was to find out what had happened to his Austrian family, and to this end he contacted the Israeli embassy in London, who told him that there were archives of names of families who went to the concentration camps, but when he contacted them and told them his family name was Katzen, they could not find any news of them on their lists. Now he was completely stunned. He only had another term at university, and his work was being disrupted by this emotional upheaval in his life. Mr. and Mrs. Lambert were most sympathetic, and after having a family get-together, they suggested that when he finished his university course, maybe he should spend his gap year in Israel and try to find out what had happened to his family. This calmed him down, and when he achieved a 2-1 in his course, he felt that he had done justice to his foster parents, and now he was free to try and find his original family. He, together with Leo, who was also spending his gap year in Israel, filled in the necessary forms and applied for a passport. He was to spend 6 months on a kibbutz and 6 months in Jerusalem studying modern Hebrew. When he arrived in Tel Aviv, he spent all his free time traipsing from office to office, trying to find out what had happened to his family, but nobody could help him. The name Katzen did not appear on any lists, and he felt he was knocking his head against a brick wall. He was sitting in the dining room of the kibbutz one day when one of the girls came and sat with him. "What's the matter, David? Can I help? You look so sad." "To tell you the truth, I am feeling really cheesed off. I've been to every office I can think of to try and find out what happened to my family, but nobody seems to be able to help me. I've told them the name over and over again, but it does not seem to appear on any of the lists, and I don't know where to go from here." "What name was it?"
"Katzen."
"Katzen? That rings a bell. I'm sure there was a girl on my training kibbutz called Katzen, but she married, and I have no idea what her married name is." "Have you any idea where she is now? She may be a distant relative or something." "I think she went down to the Negev to a kibbutz, but we can easily find out by contacting the head office. Leave it with me. I will make a few phone calls for you." Later on in the evening, she found David and told him that the girl she was talking about was on a kibbutz in the Negev called Mishmar HaNegev, and she thought that her married name was Ben-Ari. As soon as he had a free day, David went down to the Negev to find out whether or not this girl was part of his lost family, or maybe she knew something about what had happened. The secretary of the kibbutz welcomed him, and although he did not recognise the name Katzen, he knew the Ben-Ari family and took David over to their room. The door was opened by a young woman, whom invited them in and offered cold drinks. David started to explain why he had come and then all my skills as a guardian angel, to which I have made little reference in this story, came into being. The young woman was his sister. She told him with tears in her eyes that his parents had survived the concentration camps and they were happily living on the same kibbutz. They had tried and tried to find David, but all their letters had been returned. They did not know the family had moved. I will leave it to your imagination, my dear friends, what happened next. The next story I'm about to read you is very, very different. I hope you'll like it. It's quite amusing, and it's told through the eyes of a little dog. It's called The Curious Incident of a Dachshund. I have come to the conclusion that with patience and time, the human species can be trained. As a top pedigree Dachshund, I have spent the last 3 years explaining to Jane, the lady who lives with me, how to behave, and I think I am winning. For example, there are two kinds of walks. There is a walk with a capital W, and there is a walk with a small W. When I see Jane putting on her wellies and having a determined look on her face, I know that we are in for a walk with a capital W. And although I do not particularly look forward to these walks, having only 16 inches of leg divided by 4, being the superior pedigree Dachshund that I am, I think maybe it's not such a bad idea. However, I must be perfectly honest with you and say that I am eternally grateful to get home and collapse in my comfortable basket for the next 2 hours. Then there is the walk with the small W, and the story I'm going to tell you is about one of these walks. Jane, unfortunately, has been rather preoccupied lately, and I can tell from the numerous telephone calls and the expression on her face that something is bothering her. She has an aged mother who is quite frail and is often admitted to hospital. This seems to be the case at the moment, and I can sense that Jane is worried in case the situation with her mother worsens. So on this day, Jane and I are going shopping for a few delicacies that she needs for herself and to buy a few tempting goodies for her mother. I enjoy going shopping because I know that we stop and start every so often and I can have a little rest. What I don't enjoy is when Jane meets a friend on the way and has a chat. Then for about a quarter of an hour, I am totally ignored. And for a top pedigree Dachshund, that is not acceptable. I am very much hoping that our journey to the shops will not be interrupted in this way. I have to make sure that Jane goes to the toilet before we go out, because for me there is no problem in relieving myself. There are plenty of lampposts around. But when Jane needs to relieve herself, we have to go looking for a clean public toilet, which are few and far between. Jane is putting on her ordinary shoes, a little bit of makeup, and off we go. I allow her to put on my collar and lead because there are a few major roads to cross and I worry that Jane is so preoccupied that she may have an accident and I have to look after her. We arrive at the village shops with no problem whatsoever, and whilst Jane is shopping, I have time to sit and stare. A nice man talks to me and I answer him back most pleasantly. I suddenly realise that my sitting and staring has gone on for rather a long time. The kind man has disappeared, and so has Jane. Where is she? Do you know, there was I thinking that I had trained Jane to behave in a responsible, superior Dachshund way, and now it seems my training has completely failed. Where is she? A long time has passed and it's getting dark. I'm getting cold and miserable and hungry. Suddenly an impossible thought struck me. Has Jane forgotten me? Is it possible that with all the stress she has regarding her mother, that I have been ignored and forgotten? It just doesn't bear thinking about. Although I think I could find my way home, it is a bit complicated, as when your legs are only 4 inches high, you mainly see the pavements in front of you. And quite honestly, when you have seen one pavement, you have seen them all. The whole situation is getting worse and worse, as Alice said. Jane has read me the story of Alice in Wonderland several times, it being one of her favourites. By this time it is dark and the shops are shut. The street lights are on. And I have to face up to the reality that I have been abandoned. I sit quietly, and I must confess that I had a little weep. What happens next is something that really shouldn't happen even to a dog. A van pulls up, and before you know it, I am roughly picked up and thrown into the back with several other very inferior dogs, me of all dogs, me with my superior pedigree, thrown into this smelly, dirty van with all these other dogs. It just doesn't bear thinking about. I sulk and certainly do not join in the conversation. I have no idea of where we're going and what is happening. As the van stops, we are all thrust into a compound, and actually the people there are much kinder than the humans driving the van. Obviously they've had good training, and they speak kindly, give us all a cuddle, and thank goodness give us some food, because as I had had my breakfast several hours earlier, I was by that time very hungry. They, of course, realised that I was a superior pedigree Dachshund, and I was given a room to myself, quite clean and comfortable. So I relaxed a bit and promptly fell asleep. I had heard that one of the young ladies who had been kind to me was called Kate. So just before I fell asleep, Kate had come in and taken my telephone number off my collar. Having had a good sleep, the following morning Kate came in, gave me a cuddle and some breakfast, and told me that they had contacted Jane and she would be coming to pick me up very shortly. Thank goodness, I said to myself, because if I had to spend another day with all these inferior breeds, I would indeed be very unhappy. It was only a very short time before a very tearful Jane appeared. In spite of my superior behaviour, when I wanted to be very annoyed with her at the way she had treated me, I was happy to see her. She was crying and crying and could not stop hugging me and kissing me. She explained that she had had a telephone call to say that her mother's condition had worsened, and she had panicked and forgot all about me while she chased off to the hospital. I had to forgive her. She was so upset. But it only goes to show you, you think you have mastered the art of training a human, but from time to time, they still let you down. The last story I'm going to read during this session is, I think, my best story. I hope you enjoy it. It's called Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers sat in his armchair sipping a single malt whisky from a cut glass tumbler. He was feeling smug and rather contented on how well the day had gone and was congratulating himself. As soon as the advertisement for a gardener had appeared in the local newspaper, he had done his research and knew all about the family who lived in the old church barn. He knew that the house had been designed by a well-known architect who had built it for his wife when they had first married and was now protected as an outstanding piece of architecture. He also knew that the architect had died 3 years ago and that his wife, a very wealthy woman, had moved into a granny flat adjoining the house and her daughter with her husband and the little girl had moved into the main house. He had answered the advertisement for the gardener and been given an appointment for that afternoon at 2 o'clock. He had parked his Jaguar in the car park of the local supermarket. He was wearing clean but old clothes and scuffed shoes and had even coloured his hands with soil so as to create the right impression. The door had been opened by Emily, Mrs. Carruthers' daughter, who had invited him in and asked him into the kitchen. She seemed a little flustered and explained that a friend of hers had had an accident with her washing machine, which had flooded, and she was going over the road to help her. Would Mr. Rogers mind if she made him a coffee and she would be back in a few minutes? While Mr. Rogers had been sipping his coffee, Mrs. Carruthers had come into the kitchen. "Oh, who are you? Where is my daughter?" "I'm sorry, she just popped out for a minute. I've come about the gardening job." "Oh, never mind. I know it's a stupid question, but you don't happen to play bridge, do you? Our fourth has let us down." Mr. Rogers had attended the local grammar school, and in the sixth form, one of the masters had been a bridge enthusiast and had encouraged the boys to play. Mr. Rogers hated the game, as the other boys took to it much better than he had, but he still remembered the basic rules. Well, it just so happens my wife and I did play a bit, but I'm not very good. Never mind, neither are we, but if you don't mind making up the fourth, you'll be doing us a big favour. I'll explain to Emily when she gets back. She won't mind. He was introduced to the other two ladies, Barbara and Jane, and quickly realised that they were indeed beginners, and he was able to fit in quite easily. When Emily had returned and popped her head into the room, Mrs. Carruthers explained that they had borrowed Mr. Rogers for an hour or so, and she could show him around the garden when they had finished, which indeed happened. It was a big garden and had been neglected for some time, and after showing Emily his references, it was arranged that he would start work next Tuesday at 9:30. He was to come once a week for 2 to 3 hours at a rate of £7 per hour. Mr. Rogers was more than happy at the way the afternoon had gone. He walked round to the supermarket car park, got into his Jaguar and driven home, where he took off his old clothes, had a shower and rewarded himself with a stiff drink. A little about Mr. Rogers. He had been born into a poor working class family on the council estate the other side of town. His father had died when he was 12 years old, and his mother had worked as a machinist in a factory during the day and cleaned offices in the evening in order to make ends meet. She had been a good mother and had always made sure that he was clean and neat. He was bright academically and had got into the local grammar school, where he did well, particularly at maths. She had made sure he stayed at school until he was 18 and had then been offered training in the local bank as a junior teller. He was 23 when his mother died, and the council had allowed him to stay in the house for another 2 years. But after that, he had to move out and he rented a room in a private house. He still worked in the bank and had risen to the post of senior teller. Mr. Rogers had very definite views about his future. He had grown into an attractive man, stood 6 feet tall with dark hair and blue eyes, and had many girlfriends, all of whom enjoyed being with him and found the sex very satisfactory. He had moved into a small flat, comfortably furnished, but Mr. Rogers, with all his mainly physical attributes, felt that there was more to life. He decided to get married, but he knew exactly what sort of a wife he was looking for. First of all, she had to be rich. Secondly, he would prefer that she was not encumbered by lots of family. And lastly, of course, she had to fall madly in love with him. Eloise exactly fitted the bill. She was a French girl who had come to perfect her English. Her father owned vineyards in France, and she was an only daughter. She attended English language classes during the day, and in the evening studied English literature at evening classes, where she met Mr. Rogers. Although she wasn't the most beautiful girlfriend he had had, she was sweet and charming, and when she spoke English with a French accent, he was quite smitten. With his charm and good looks, Eloise very quickly responded to him, and in no time they became an item. When 6 months later she told her father she wanted to get married, French Papa came over to interview his future son-in-law. When he saw how happy his only daughter was, he arranged a beautiful wedding for them in France. The friends and relatives danced through the vineyards, and Eloise and Mr. Rogers returned to England. French Papa had put down a hefty deposit on a beautiful detached house in a gated mews in Stafford, and they happily settled down to married life. The mews in which they lived had 6 houses in it, and the Rogers lived at number 4. On either side of the mews were 2 large cedar trees, and all the front gardens were immaculate. The spring bedding plants and winter shrubs created a colourful environment, but the closed gates made sure that only the people who lived there were welcome. The code to the security gates was a closely guarded secret. Mr. Rogers still worked at the bank, and in no time the mortgage was paid off. For the next 8 years they enjoyed their married life. Holidays were spent in France. They travelled extensively throughout the world. And although French Papa would have liked a grandchild, this did not happen. Eloise became ill. She had pains in her stomach and her joints were painful. The doctor could not find anything specifically wrong with her and advised rest and painkillers. But the condition became worse and poor Eloise died at the tender age of 36. A post-mortem was held. Nothing untoward came of their findings and Mr. Rogers was issued with a death certificate which stated death from natural causes. Inherited just under £1 million, which was safely stashed away in an offshore account. With his comfortable house, plenty of money and good health, Mr. Rogers spent the next few years enjoying his bachelorhood. He became a member of the golf club, he had a good sense of humour, was popular with the in crowd and continued his relationships with all the pretty ladies. He'd given up his job at the bank and with his financial experience became a Lloyd's broker in a brokering firm in the city. He found the journey to the city arduous. Also, it interfered with his golf. So he made arrangement with the owner of the firm that he would work 3 days a week, which suited them both. And then he met Julie. Julie was an American girl whose father owned a bank. She had come to England to learn about English banking methods, and her father had made arrangements for her to work in Mr. Rogers' old bank. Mr. Rogers often used to pop into the bank from time to time to see his old working colleagues, and when he was introduced to Julie, all sorts of thoughts started to jump around in his head. He'd been without a wife for several years and thought maybe the time had come to settle down again. Julie fitted the bill. She'd been married and divorced. She was very attractive and very rich. Was she potentially Mrs. Rogers' number two, said Mr. Rogers? He decided to pursue his aim, and sure enough, Julie eagerly responded. She loved his home. He was good-looking and fun to be with. He was very good in bed. So what more could a girl want? In no time, she became Mrs. Rogers' number two. Julie, however, was much more amenable than Eloise. They'd only been married 4 years when she died from breast cancer. Mr. Rogers was consoled by the fact that he inherited £1.5 million. His offshore account now totaled £3 million. Mr. Rogers had now fulfilled his aim in life. He was financially secure. He enjoyed his part-time job. He played golf 3 times a week, and there was no shortage of ladies. He was now in his mid-50s and getting bored. When he saw the advertisement for the gardening job, something stirred inside him. The council house where he had lived as a boy had a small garden, and his mother, in whatever little time she had had from her various jobs, loved to garden and encouraged Mr. Rogers to work with her. He'd always enjoyed gardening and spent many hours tending the large garden attached to his house. Twice a year he called in professionals to do some of the heavy work, but mainly he looked after the garden himself. So when he saw the advertisement for a gardener at the old church barn, he had no problems applying for the job. He was looking for a bit of excitement, and although he didn't really know what he was letting himself in for, at least it would be something different to the humdrum life he was leading at present. The interview had gone well. His reference had been accepted, but the game of bridge was an unexpected happening, which had added to the excitement of the afternoon. And so Mr. Rogers felt he had earned his single malt whiskey. Mr. Rogers started work in the March. He bought an old van, some second-hand gardening equipment, and promptly turned up every Tuesday morning at 9:30. The garden had been neglected, and there was plenty of work for him to do. The steps leading down from the patio were crumbling, and Emily had asked a local firm to come in and repair them. Around about 11 o'clock, Emily made a cup of coffee for Mr. Rogers, and often she and her mother sat on the patio with him, chatting about nothing in particular. When Katie, Emily's daughter, was on school holidays, she worked with him in the garden, and he gave her a little plot of her own, of which she was immensely proud. 6 months passed, and the garden was beginning to take shape, when one Tuesday morning, while Mr. Rogers was tending the roses, he heard a cry and saw Mrs. Carruthers lying at the foot of the stone steps. One of the builders had left a large hammer at the bottom of the steps and Mrs. Carruthers had fallen over it. She seemed to be in a great deal of pain and Mr. Rogers went into the house looking for Emily, but she was out. He helped Mrs. Carruthers into his van and drove her to the local casualty department, where after various x-rays, it was discovered that she had broken her ankle. The ankle was plastered up to her knee, painkillers were prescribed, and Mr. Rogers gently helped her into his van and took her home. Mrs. Carruthers had phoned her daughter, who could not thank Mr. Rogers enough for the kindness he had shown to her mother. Mrs. Carruthers was helped into bed and again thanked Mr. Rogers for his help. As he was leaving, Mr. Rogers asked Emily if she would allow him to come and visit Mrs. Carruthers while she was unable to get about, and of course Emily said that would be perfectly all right. For the next few weeks, Mr. Rogers came almost every day to see Mrs. Carruthers. They played cards together, they drank coffee together, and their relationship started to change from being the lady of the manor and the gardener, so to speak, to that of friends. She asked him to call her Cecilia, and he said his name was Kenneth. In spite of the fact that he was now mid-50s, he was still an attractive man with slightly greying hair and sparkling blue eyes. He reminded her of the film star Michael Douglas, and she found herself enjoying his company. On the days when he could not visit, she missed him. When the time came for the plaster to be cut off, it was Mr. Rogers who took her to the hospital, and it was Mr. Rogers who supported her when she took her first few steps. Mr. Rogers was in a dilemma. He was falling in love with Cecilia, but having created Mr. Rogers the gardener, he did not know how to extricate himself from being Mr. Rogers the gardener to being the rich Mr. Rogers. Emily was having coffee in her kitchen with a friend one day while Mr. Rogers was working in the garden. "Is that your gardener, Emily?" asked Jenny. "Yes, of course, he's been with us quite a few months now. He was very kind to my mother when she had her accident. Why do you ask?" "Oh, I don't know. I thought I saw him at the golf club, but I must have been mistaken. They say everybody has a double." "Well, I'm sure you're wrong. I can't imagine Mr. Rogers could afford to be a member of the golf club." A month or so later, Emily was in the local supermarket when she thought she saw Mr. Rogers pulling a trolley around, but he was dressed entirely differently to the gardening clothes he usually wore. When she tried to catch up with him, he had disappeared, so she thought she was just imagining things. In the meantime, the relationship between her mother and Mr. Rogers was growing serious. He had finally invited her to have dinner with him at a small Italian restaurant, and she had accepted. The evening went very well, and in spite of herself, Cecilia found herself physically attracted to him. She was 52 years old when her husband had died. He was 11 years older than her. And when he had died, it never entered her mind that she would ever have another man in her life. And here she was feeling like a teenager whenever Mr. Rogers was near her. He too sensed that their relationship was entering into a new phase, and he rented a flat in the town just in case. Well, the just in case proved to be right, and before long the bedroom in the flat became very much used. Cecilia could not believe how much she enjoyed snuggling up to him and the warmth his body gave. The sex with her husband had been all right, but this was different, more mature, more confident, and much more enjoyable. Emily could see a change in her mother. Her eyes were sparkling, her whole demeanour was youthful. She was clearly enjoying life, but Emily was getting a little worried. Her mother was a very wealthy woman, and when her father had died, many men hovered around hoping to marry her and share her wealth, but she had ignored them all. Now she was falling for the gardener of all people, and Emily was a little concerned. What did they know about Mr. Rogers? Very little. Unlike her usual trusting nature, she decided to look up the references that Mr. Rogers had given her 2 years earlier. She had been so taken with him at the first interview that she had never followed them up, and she really had no idea where they were, or even if she'd kept them. She looked through her desk, which was covered with various papers, and finally found them under a pile of Katie's school reports. The telephone was answered by a woman. "Forgive me for bothering you, but my name is Emily Grant, and I wonder if you could help me. We've advertised for a gardener, and Mr. Rogers gave you as a reference. Was he okay?" "Who did you say?" "Mr. Rogers." "Just a minute, I'll ask my husband. Tony, darling, do you remember the gardener we had last year? Was his name Rogers?" "Rogers? I don't think so. I think it was Marshall. Sorry. The second telephone call was also unsatisfactory. An alarm bell started to ring in Emily's brain. When she spoke to her husband, his response was equally dismissive. What are you worrying about? Lady Chatterley had an affair with her gardener. It's just one of those things. Your mother's just having a midlife fling. But her mother wasn't some character in a story. Her mother was a real person. And Emily was getting increasingly worried. The private detective agency she went to did not think she was being overcautious. It was run by a father and son. And when Emily made the appointment, it was a son who interviewed her. He made her feel comfortable. He was very easy to talk to and said he would make a few inquiries and get back to her as soon as possible. His charges were £350 per week, to which she agreed. When the phone rang 10 days later and his voice invited her to come along to his office as he had some news for her, she was relieved. At least she felt she was doing something to calm her fears down, and she very much hoped that her fears had amounted to nothing more than an anxious daughter trying to protect her mother. The young detective's manner was grave when she sat in his office. When he started to tell her the information he had obtained about Mr. Rogers, she could not believe what she was hearing. He owned a large house in one of the most prestigious parts of the town. He had a year-old Jaguar in his garage. He'd been married twice before, and he had an offshore saving account. He could not discover how much Mr. Rogers had in his account because that was private, but usually people with offshore accounts were pretty wealthy. Emily was stunned and burst into tears. The nice young detective comforted her and supplied her with tissues. It's not unusual, believe me. Your mother is a rich woman, and it's possible that he was trying to make her Mrs. Rogers number three. Emily cried all the way home. She knew she had to tell her mother what she had discovered, but she dreaded doing so. They had all become so fond of Mr. Rogers, and she knew that her mother had, to all extents, fallen in love with him. To now tell her that he had lied from the very beginning was going to be very difficult. After dinner that evening, she poured herself and her mother a large brandy. "Mum, could you spare a minute? I want to talk to you." To her amazement, her mother took the news better than she had expected. There had always been something a little odd about the man. He hardly ever spoke about himself. Apart from that one mention of a wife when they had invited him to play bridge that first afternoon, he had never mentioned her again and seemed reluctant to talk about his past. She took the news calmly and retired to her bedroom early. The following evening, as usual, she met Mr. Rogers in their favourite Italian restaurant and went back to his flat. She undressed and got into bed and snuggled up to him as if nothing extraordinary had happened. "Tell me, Kenneth, you hardly ever talk about your past. What happened to your first wife, Eloise? Did you murder her? And the lovely American girl, Julie, she did you a favour, didn't she? She just died from natural causes, or so they say. Did you give her a push too?" There was no reply. Slowly Cecilia got out of bed and dressed. "You have lied to me from the very beginning. You wormed your way into our family and you encouraged me to fall in love with you. There are no words to describe how utterly despicable I find you now. Don't come near me or my family again. If you do, I will call the police and have you arrested." Several months passed. Mr. Rogers ended the lease on the small flat, sold the van and the gardening tools, and went back to his old life. Nothing, however, seemed quite the same. He missed the family very much. He had genuinely fallen in love, possibly for the first time in his life, with Cecilia, and was ashamed of the way he had behaved. He missed the garden. He missed the coffee breaks. He missed Katie planting her little garden. And he was lonely and depressed. He still played golf occasionally. One day at the golf club, a fed said to him, "Have you heard the news? The rich lady from the old church barn, you know, the one who gave the local hospital £50,000 towards a new extension, is getting married to an American millionaire. Apparently she had a fling with somebody or other, and people are gossiping that she is marrying on the rebound. They're going to live 6 months in America and 6 months over here. Some people have all the luck." Poor Mr. Rogers. Back home, he poured himself another whiskey.